Daniel Turner, Power of the Future Executive Director.
Thank you for joining the program here today. We're going to the phone line, the Industrial Forest Studios here, and tell me a little bit about this organization and podcast that you... Wait, you've got a podcast, right?
I do not have a podcast, no, but I'm happy to be on other podcasts.
My goodness, you're the one man in America that doesn't have a podcast right now. My pet's got four of them, so, you know. It's the Dog Days podcast. No, I'm just kidding. But talk to me a little bit about your company, what it is you do.
Yeah, so I started Power of the Future. I'm the founder of it about 4 years ago. And I founded it because there was a huge disconnect in the energy space between the people who make energy policy decisions, and they're based in Washington, D.C., or some of the power brokers, especially in the environmental power brokers, are in places like New York and San Francisco, and the communities they impact, which are found predominantly in rural America. And I live in rural America. I got a farm, and I love this industry, and I was working in the energy space. And I would see that when folks who make policy decisions about fracking, about setbacks, about methane rules, let alone the myriad decisions about coal industry, they never visit those parts of America where those decisions are impacted, and what it means to jobs, what it means to local revenue, what it means to those small towns across the country. And that huge disconnect began to bother me more and more. I felt like rural American energy workers needed someone to advocate on their behalf. So I started Power the Future for that purpose.
In my former life, when I was in publishing, we were a magazine publisher, and our clients were newspapers. So we were kind of the print industry, so to speak. And we had 52 newspapers as clients, and a couple of them were up there in New Jersey and the New York area, New York State. Two things I remember about my travels there. One, I'm from the Midwest. Like, I didn't even know what a Mormon was until I was 19 years old. So, and that's a true story, actually, because I met one in California, and I'm like, what now? What's this all about? Like, I had never even heard of this before, right? So when I got out there, of course, you think of New York, and I think most people just think New York is one big city. Just it's the city of New York, and that's the state. And that wasn't the case. I was just, Derry stood out in my mind in New York. How many different just pastures of cows and et cetera. New Jersey, cranberries. Wow, I didn't even realize that they grew cranberries in New Jersey. But, man, that's got to be, like, the number one crop there. So talk to me a little bit about that disconnect, or is that am I isolated here with that?
No, you're absolutely right. And I am originally from New York City. So I am not I wasn't born and raised in rural America. I'm not a farmer by birth. So I should fall in the other side of the equation. Those people who do feel that by their birthright and because of their urban sophistication should make policy decisions. You take someone like Chuck Schumer, who said, I was born to legislate. And that's kind of a dangerous mantra, right? No one is born to tell other people how to live their life. But because of work and because of just my career path, I started spending more and more time in rural America and then living here. And that's when I developed this great appreciation for the people who obviously produce our energy, but they also grow our food. They raise all of our livestock. They manufacture most of our goods. They fight most of our wars, quite frankly. And, you know, in the course of my lifetime, I'm in my late 40s now, in the course of my lifetime, America has gone from a country that is predominantly rural with a huge population in the cities to a country that is predominantly urban with a huge population in rural America. We have flip-flopped in the last 40, 50 years. And the problem with that is that you do find folks like Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, and I don't want to be, everyone, she's the punching bag for the right, and I get it, but I'm not making fun of her for policy decisions. I'm just saying she's emblematic of someone who is young, who is from urban America, who is cosmopolitan, but feels that by her birthright, by her position, she should make policy decisions, and she does make energy policy decisions, but she doesn't know energy workers. She's never lived in rural America. She's never really been probably in any energy community. In fact, there's a funny Instagram video of her with a thermo reader, and she's talking about a fracking machine, and she's putting her little heat reader on the quote unquote fracking machine, saying look at all the pollution. And you say, well, if you put your quote unquote, there's no such thing as a fracking machine, first of all, that was her vernacular. But if you put that on a microwave or a toaster oven or on a car engine, it would read hot because it's an active machine. So her ignorance doesn't stop her from making policy decisions when it comes to energy, even though she's so far removed from the rural communities that produce our energy. I'm convinced if there was a coal mine in the middle of Manhattan and she knew coal workers, she would feel differently. Or if there were, wellheads, and she knew people who worked in the oil and gas space, she would think differently. But she doesn't know these people, and therefore she doesn't have any respect for them and feels that she can regulate them out of existence.
We had a Democratic state senator up here in North Dakota one year when the wind energy, is about 10 years ago when wind energy was getting, really kicking off. And somebody with a wind turbine called, and this is when I was doing the talk radio show, and they were complaining. And, of course, the state senator was defending wind energy, and they challenged the state senator to come out and spend a night. So the state senator did. The next week, the state senator was not in favor of wind energy, said that we had to make some changes because of the humming and the noise that was, and I think that they started talking about setbacks and certain things like that. How much of this is just the disconnect like that? Because the example I gave you was a politician who was speaking without knowing what they were talking about. Somebody gave him the opportunity to say, hey, listen, I know what I'm talking about. I live it every day, and you're speaking on my behalf. Why don't you come on in and walk in my shoes for a day? Why is it that we can't get the politicians, who are the elected officials of the people, to walk in the shoes of the people for a day, whether it be, the climate czar, which is almost seems like a sensational word, but it's the actual legitimate word. Climate czar John Kerry taking private jets over to Egypt the other day to scold everybody on climate change. You can't make it up.
Absolutely. And that disconnect is going to be a growing source of anger and tension and God, I hope not, but maybe even one day violence, because when you have someone like John Kerry who has said on the record, for someone like me, just think of that phrase, for someone like me, private jet is the only way to travel if you use setbacks. And so there are three parts of that statement. One, someone like me, so obviously we're not part of that, right? Because I'm not someone like John Kerry. He made his money the old-fashioned way, I joke. He married a rich widow. And so someone like him, it's the only way. It's not the only way to travel. It's the preferred way to travel. When he went to Reykjavik, when he made that statement, I looked online. There were 7 commercial flights that day to Reykjavik. So it wasn't the only – from New York City. So it wasn't the only way to travel. It was just the preferred way to travel. And then the third part is if you use carbon offsets. Well, why can't the whole darn American economy use carbon offsets, right? If John Kerry can use a private jet, the carbon emissions from his private jet flight to Reykjavik is more than the average American who doesn't fly private will use an entire calendar year. Well, if John Kerry can use offsets to keep his private jet travel, why can't you and I use offsets to keep our, for example, gas stoves? I was just doing an interview earlier today where they're talking in New York City about they've already banned natural gas for new construction. You can't have natural gas for home heating, for your hot water heater, for your stove going forward now. Well, why can't I offset the way John Kerry can? You know why? Because only someone like him, rich, powerful, connected, special, important, whatever phrase you want to use, and he's allowed to offset, but you and I cannot. You know, one of the leaders of the green movement financially is Michael Bloomberg, who's worth $60 billion. I don't begrudge him a dime of his wealth. He started his own company. He made a great product. That's the American dream. But Michael Bloomberg has 14 houses around the world. I would have 14 houses too if I had $60 billion. He has a fleet of private jets. He's also an accomplished pilot, and he has a fleet of private helicopters because he likes to fly. I don't begrudge him any of that. But Michael Bloomberg spends hundreds of millions of dollars a year through the Sierra Club to shut down coal plants in rural West Virginia, to shut down fracking in the Permian Basin and in North Dakota. Michael Bloomberg's not going to ever land in Artesia, New Mexico, because there's no Four Seasons, right? There's no Michelin star restaurant. But he will tell the poor people of Artesia, New Mexico, that they can or cannot do their job. They can and cannot make money. And that's the disconnect that is really dividing our country politically, but causing a huge problem in our energy industry.
One of the ways I'm having a disconnect with a lot of, I'm having a very big disconnect with the rich, but mostly the entitled rich, not self-made millionaires. People who are self-made, I connect with 100%. A lot of people who get government entitlements, I do not connect with. And some of this younger generation, I'm beginning to not connect with more and more. And when I grew up, I'll be honest, I grew up baptized a Catholic. I was an altar boy. I went to a private school. I taught Sunday school. I was pretty active in the church because I gravitated towards leadership. And I'll be honest, when I hit the age of reason, I joke, I left the church. I stayed spiritual. I stayed nonprofits, and I do a lot of volunteering. But I felt the church had gotten very political and had gotten almost like a business. And so I struggle with that. But where I'm going with this, I was raised that there was a separation of church and state. The church brought in kind of the ethics and the morals into your life, and your people of the cloth were there to help guide you through that. The state was there to bring in universal laws that really didn't bring in any ethics or morals or anything. It's just, hey, we need roads, don't we? So we're going to have roads. Well, I get that this is a loaded question because that can go a million different directions. What I want to know is this part of why there's a disconnect there? Because is this really an ethical-based thing? Is the church so far removed from everyday culture that the state is just what these young kids think the church is now? So no matter what the state, what the state says, that's what is good for your heart, body, and soul. Mind, body, soul. There we go. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, you get what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to bring this into like some big philosophical existential thing. I'm actually trying to ask a simple question, to be honest.
So. No, I think you're raising a really great and important point. Like, why is this movement as big and as powerful as it is? And I like you, was also raised Catholic and know my catechism. And the catechism does say that man has a universal longing for God. But if you don't have God in your life, you have other sources of beliefs. And I do think climate change is a belief. It's a religion, and it's deeply devout to these folks, and the environment is deeply devout. And that is why they talk about people who don't agree with you as deniers, right? Or they tell you that you need to believe in the science. You know, we even saw that with COVID. Well, science doesn't require a belief. And it's funny that to make that parallel, In the latest COVID conversations, we've been told by the CDC and by the press secretary of the White House that the science has changed. Has climate science changed? Absolutely not. You tell them, no, that science, it doesn't change. The science is settled. And we said, well, that's fascinating. So I think there is such a fervor in this movement because if people have a longing for what is deep and spiritual and meaningful, and if you don't have anything in your life, whether it's religion, whether it's family, then you will find that purpose and fill it with something else. And radical environmentalism is a very strongly held religious belief, and that's why it's hard to deal with these folks in the sense of logic, in the sense of the history of religion in the last 2,000 years is marching people off to their deaths because they didn't believe what I believed. And the environmental left, it will gladly march people off to their deaths if they don't believe what they want you to believe. we have 30,000 children right now working in slave mines in the Congo to mine cobalt and lithium for electric vehicles. Now, that's not a hyperbolic statement. That is a fact. The UN has acknowledged the fact. No one gives a damn about those 30,000 Congolese slave children. We talk about, well, we have to save the planet. Well, what about the 30,000 Congolese slave children? Who cares about them? Right? Doesn't matter. I mean, how many? We have 2 million Uyghurs that work in factories making solar panels. Does anyone care about those slaves? No. Why? Because we need solar panels. Why? Because we have to save the planet. So this is a religious belief that has become almost maniacal. Who the hell are we saving the planet for? I mean, if we're enslaving children around the world, what planet are we saving it for? And also, again, going back to the urban and rural divide, you think the planet needs to be saved, and I can say this as a New Yorker, because you look at New York and you think that's the world, and New York right now is a pigsty. It's not the New York I grew up in. It's filthy. It's full of homeless people. It's full of crack addicts. There's garbages piled up. If that's your experience, if that's your Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and you look at that and you say the planet's dying, the planet's suffering, pollution, stench, filth, have you ever set foot in regular America? I live about 2 hours outside of D.C., not very, very far, still the East Coast. You should see the stars. Right? You should see the color of the streams and the water in the streams. And I don't see any of your filth, but you don't have that experience. So your religion and your experience is dictating terms that for the rest of us. I love the direction this conversation is going. It's not what I expected, but this is fun.
I was just going to say the exact same thing. We've got Daniel Turner on the line with us. He's with the Power the Future. It's a foundation, I guess, executive director, Power the Future. It's a advocacy group. Is that correct?
It is, but now okay. It sounds like it's a philosophical group as well.
That's why I wanted to reset the conversation a little bit. We are going to talk about Nord 2, Russia, and the Ukraine, and how this might actually increase some of the energy prices here in the United States, and we might become reliant on Russian energy when this is all said and done. But I did want to get back to what we were talking about, the religion of the environment, because 5 years ago, I actually tried to preach this message to the oil and gas industry, and I got a little bit of the temperature in the room went down very cold towards me, and I thought it had to do with the word religion a little bit, so I changed the word to cult, and that was a little bit too harsh too, and so it was very hard because we live in this world where triggers happen so quickly. And you got to be such a wordsmither now and stay ahead of the game that there are
exactly.
There are people who make a living just waking up in the morning and changing keywords. That's the reality of the world we live in with wordsmithing now. So anyway, it wasn't lost on me. My point that I was trying to make to a lot of the people out there was very similar to what you were talking about. But I took it a step further and said, listen, the Garden of Eden is very similar to the Earth. And so what the environmentalists, the climate activists, because I'm an environmentalist, I've adopted a highway since 2002 by myself. I didn't need any corporate sponsorships to do it. I've been a vegan for almost 14, 15 years. Had to add some fish because of some B12 issues and a cancer battle a few years ago. But I'm very comfortable with calling myself an environmentalist. My friends call me the hippie capitalist because I'm like a libertarian that's a hippie. It's really weird. But I'm like an old Goldwater conservative. Government, stay out of my checkbook and stay out of my personal life. I'll pay for roads and schools. That's cool. Okay. But, hey, I don't this other stuff I'm not so keen on. Anyway, that's be that as it may. Okay. Getting back to the religion of the environment part, I started seeing this connection with the younger folks when the churches started having trouble. Churches started having to start taking out loans. Well, now they're going against their own teaching because in the New Testament, not the Old Testament, in the New Testament, Jesus flipped the table when the money changers were in the temple. And so that was a way for the churches not to go into debt, basically. In fact, in Islam, it's even illegal to have interest. So, I mean, there's been teachings about this since the dawn of time, that when you go into debt, you essentially don't own yourself anymore. So I started seeing how the church has changed. They started becoming political. Where I'm from, they had to start removing some of the deacons because the deacons were becoming extremely political up there on a Sunday morning. So when the churches started having their issues, and then there was the, you know, anyway, we don't need to get into that. I started seeing the younger folk gravitate towards this environmental movement. And I went, ooh, now we're talking about original sin, because man now has destroyed the Garden of Eden. And now we need to go repent. I started seeing just these Christian similarities with the new generation. And it really made me just pause. Really made me pause. So we started, you know, talking about this and started going through it. And I think it's there. I really do. I think people are so connected with the environment, because you can go outside and you can feel connected with it. You're connected with your emotions and you can touch it and feel it. And oh, the dirty smokestack, and now you got this Pepsi bottle in the ocean and all kinds of stuff. It's there, man. I'm glad someone else sees it too. That's all.
Absolutely. And it also is, it stems from, I think, an awful lot of ignorance. It's kind of the way, you know, Plato envisioned the world as this perfect ideal that we can slowly aspire to. And it's not, right? I mean, we believe in paradise, but I don't think we can actually establish it on this earth. There's this belief that the environment was this pristine and perfect place, and mankind has ruined it. And quite frankly, it's the opposite. The environment was this incredibly dangerous, untamable world, and mankind is thriving because of it. So if you ask people in the environmental movement, they'll tell you, well, since the 1850s, temperatures have gone up 2 degrees and sea levels have risen 6 or 7 inches. Totally agree. I'll give that you that. Well, let's have that conversation. I will acknowledge all of those facts. But I will also acknowledge the facts that in the last 150, 170 years, the vast majority of mankind has moved from poverty into the middle class. In fact, the extreme poor of the world is almost a negligible number, whereas just 100 years ago, it was almost half the world. Infant mortality rates have dropped tremendously. Life expectancy is better. Literacy is higher. The world is safer. It's cleaner. It's healthier. I would say those are good trade-offs, right? I would say that fossil fuels has enabled mankind to progress to the extent that your average American lives a better, safer, warmer, healthier life than any English king or queen could have possibly dreamed of, right? I mean, we don't die from simple diseases because of fossil fuels, and we don't die, you know, frequently from the elements because of fossil fuels, and not just because we can heat and air condition our homes, but because of the clothing, all the millions of petrochemical products that we've made. Heck, the vaccines that saved the world from COVID are all derived from petrochemicals. And so when I want to sit down with especially young people, and you know, I asked my Catholic high school if I could go and speak to them about this and was summarily told no. You know, I also pointed out that Andrew Cuomo is still in their Hall of Fame as a distinguished alumnus, and I didn't hear back from the school principal because of that.
Right,
so
right.
When you said the church can be political, there's an example. But I feel like young people need to know that. What are the trade-offs? Yes, the air is maybe warmer and the sea levels are maybe higher. You can argue whether or not fossil fuels contributed to that, but regardless, they are. But boy, we are a better planet because of it. I mean, we've been told for 50 years now, since Paul Ehrlich in the 60s and 70s, that we would run out of food. We produce more food with less water every day. And the population is exploding. People say, well, the Earth can't sustain this population. Clearly it can, because we're not dying from hunger. Right, we are the world was in the 80s when World Live, Band-Aid, Live Aid, whatever that concert was. How come we don't have Ethiopian famine anymore? Are you telling me it's because there's no more droughts? There's no more? Or has the world gotten, even since the 80s, since Bono wrote that crappy song, we've gotten that much better, that much more sophisticated, that much more technology in agriculture and farming. I see those as incredible. So if you want to talk about religion, I see that as a blessing of God. I see that as that there is a God in this world and he's made the world a better place for more people. It's sad that the radical environmentalist sees it as something detrimental. I don't know what, again, the ideal environment you have in your head, it doesn't exist. And if we're going to go to battle over reality versus fantasy world, this battle is never going to come to an end.
So if I were to put on my news, my gumshoe news hat, or my award-winning producer's hat, I would say that, and I'm being totally serious here, the number one issue right now in climate change is the disconnection of the politicians. And the more and more that I hear from people and more I look into this, this is a real serious issue, the disconnect, and it needs to be addressed immediately. And I'll give you an example. You brought up the blood minerals, the conflict minerals. Now, they used to be called blood minerals. In fact, Apple still calls them blood minerals, but the UN calls them conflict minerals because conflict is a little bit, you know, less aggressive, you know, kind of like shell shock is a little too aggressive for PTSD, you know.
And because the Secretary General of the United Nations, it's not his kid who's working in that mine.
Exactly.
So it's the nomenclature because I'm not the one who's 15-year-old boy, 15, I wish they were 15. I'm not the one whose 7-year-old daughter is working in that quote-unquote conflict mine. What a load of crap. What cowardice.
At gunpoint, mind you. Okay, so this last week, actually, it's so funny you brought that up. This conversation is very serendipitous, folks. We had it booked through a booking agency that we mutually know, and so we didn't even really get a chance to prep on this phone call at all. But I do a weekly column called ESG University, Environmental Social Governance University, and we go at it pretty hard. We'll take a company to task, and we'll take ourselves to task, and we'll, you know, have somebody else on that is doing great things, and, you know, all the gamut. This last week, our title is ESG University. Could ESG really stand for Executive Saul Goodman? And what we're talking about is how Saul Goodman is in charge right now of this ESG movement, because there are companies that are being penalized on websites that are giving ESG scores when there's no criteria. There's no actual criteria. I've been sued for less, okay? And I can go to Yahoo Finance, type in Marathon Oil, Exxon Oil, Phillips 66, and it's going to give me an ESG score. And next to that ESG score, it says the word severe. Now, when I type up Apple, Disney, Adidas, what's the other one I did? Don't want to leave them out. Nike, Apple, Walt Disney, and Adidas. They all have low ESG scores. Every one of those companies has been repeatedly cited for third world country violations for their human rights, whether it's sweatshops or mining minerals at gunpoint. I raised the question in this week's ESG column, how is it that a fossil fuel company is being penalized when there's no rules for keeping the lights on and the heat on currently today for people, while other people speculating about the future are getting a pass, holding people at gunpoint, doing real, actual rape, murder, human atrocities on a daily basis? So what are we judging for our ESG score here? Are you following this ESG movement? Have you got any sort? This is when I finally said enough's enough. This is marketing, folks. Let's get a handle on it.
The ESG movement it does what a lot of, so let's get back into philosophy now. It does what a lot of postmodern movements do, in that it takes the patina of values of the West. It gives the impression that this is a good thing, but it's really all a bunch of lies. It's a genuinely destructive or you know, effort, but it tries to hide under this. We just care about, again, you know, environmental stewardship, social goodness, etc. These postmodern virtues or postmodern values that are actually destructive. So yeah, the ESG movement and corporations are afraid of it, and the corporations that are buying into it are, again, those organizations that, like that Winston Churchill quote, it's the man who feeds the alligator, the appeaser, is the man who feeds the crocodile, hoping to get eaten last. And so if you are one of these huge corporations, you are buying into the ESG movement because you know that whether it's Greta Thunberg or Antifa, they're not going to knock down your doors anytime soon. They'll go somewhere else. And so they buy them off, and they buy them off. But they're not going to leave you alone if you're the fossil fuel industry. And again, I one of my frustrations with this industry that I try to advocate for, although I really advocate for the workers, not so much the workers in rural America, not so much. I don't advocate for corporate interests whatsoever. But one of my frustrations with the corporations of this industry is that they do play this game hoping that they can buy the activists off and they will be left alone. And they've been so browbeaten for so long that heck, you look at commercials for if you ever see an energy producing company make a TV commercial, it's a diverse group of children in a laboratory looking at microscopes talking about algae. I want to say, if I had Daniel Turner Oil Company and it was a multi-billion dollar conglomerate, my commercial would be this: Daniel Turner Energy Company, if you don't like me, drive, you know, walk to work, period. Like, we make oil, and because of that, you have a great life. If you don't like it, bugger off. Yeah, you know, they're so browbeaten. They're so accustomed to thinking that they produce something which is bad, which is detrimental. And the Biden administration is buying into that, the way they're using FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the way they want to use climate change to assess infrastructure projects. Heck, they just shut down a pipeline permitting process because of climate change. The way he wants to use the Federal Reserve with his nominees, especially Sarah Bloom Raskin, to decide if climate change should penalize loans to banks. And if you're a bank and you've got climate, if you've got oil or gas companies on your books as having done financing, we're going to charge you higher base points as the Fed, because we consider that to be a risky investment. No, investing in oil and gas isn't risky. Oh, but climate change is, right? They want to turn this industry into something sinful. And again, that's a religious belief. They want to turn it into something that is inherently bad. So if you thought the COVID nonsense was terrible, wait till they turn climate change into the next public health scare. Because if you tell people this is for your public health, you can do anything. You can shut down their church. You can shut down their school. You can tell them they can't go to work. You can tell them they can't leave their damn house because it's good for their public health. And that's the religious aspect, which the Biden administration is sadly glomming on. And people need to start pushing back. I feel like I started Power of the Future 5 years ago, preparing for this moment, quite frankly.
Well, let's talk about that, because I can recall 2017, 2018, 2019, when I started sitting with these high-powered executives. You know, I mean, people who are making very good money and making big decisions for companies, whether it be public companies or, you know, the board, chairman of the board and the CEOs and things like that. These are people who are paid a lot of money to make big decisions. And I started talking about how this movement reminded me of the smoking ban. And it's almost like they were starting to go the public health route. And, oh, I would get kicked out of meetings. Just kicked out, because if you don't talk exactly the right language, they don't want anything to do with you. And in some circles, they'll blacklist you too.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about the responsibility of the oil and gas industry, because I can remember not even 2 years ago, I was in Dallas, Texas, and I said that, do you understand you are now the new big tobacco? And that was the end of the meeting, with four people who at least were making $500,000 a piece, 2 days later, the front page of the Wall Street Journal is calling Big Oil Big Tobacco.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been laughed out of many a boardroom myself trying to, because we are a C4, right? So I need to raise money. I have a staff and I've been laughed out of many a board meeting when I say what my vision is. People are like, I can't give you money. You're a lunatic. You don't believe in that. You know, we have a responsibility to combat climate. Like, and I say, I know what you mean, but when you start using their language, then you're playing the game on their terms. And you don't have a responsibility to combat climate change. You have a responsibility to produce your product in the most environmentally, ethically, and responsibly and efficient way to keep a price point that the average person can still afford your product. That's how you should talk about these things. But again, if you're making a few million dollars a year as like the vice president of government relations for name the company here, you don't want to be told by some idiot kid from Queens, New York, how you should be talking about these issues. And so, yeah, I've made some enemies where I should be making friends, but I'm not going to back down from that position. Don't speak their language. And that's what the industry as a whole is doing. And it's hurting them. They're losing, quite frankly. We are losing this battle. And now people are going to say,
you're getting me happy, man.
Oil is at $92 a barrel. You're going to tell me these guys are unhappy? And I'm telling you right now, they are happy. And that doesn't make me happy. I don't want oil to be $92 a barrel. Right now, they are doing well. But there is someone on their board in their company who is looking at the permitting process the Biden administration is shutting down, the EPA regulations that are coming. They are looking at 5 months into the future, and they are saying, we are going to get our teeth kicked in, because we are running out of opportunity. This is an industry that wants to work on volume, not on price. And their volume is going to come under a huge assault, intentionally so. The Biden administration wants this. And the reason why it's all happening is because however many years ago, we started speaking their language, hoping to be eaten last. Let's just, let me sit down with Greta Thunberg and have this conversation. Give me a break. I saw that CEO sit down on the stage with her. That insults me, quite frankly. That insults me that he did that. But here
we're going to have to send our mutual Booker friend, Rachel, a nice gift, because she hit the nail on the head by putting us together, because she said, I think you guys will hit it off. I want to read something to you from my latest ESG column here, because I kind of stumbled and tiptoed when I was talking about that human rights and the ESG and things like that, because I was trying to find it. Well, I found it. Okay, this brings up an interesting question regarding ESG and their criteria for scores. How is worrying and speculating about the future of the climate garnering more negative attention for investing than the current human rights atrocities Apple, Nike, Disney, and Adidas are currently committing? I would even push the envelope of this subjective ESG issue to mental health. Forever 21, who is a private company, is not only one of the top sweatshop users, but in my opinion, their quest for the eternal youth message contributes to more mental health issues in society than CNN and Fox News combined. So, exactly. Now, I wanted to get to the other part, which is how we are connecting once again. What I get into with this executive Saul Goodman column is that at the end of the day, Saul Goodman is a product of Jimmy McGill. Jimmy McGill tried to play by the rules. They kept changing the rules on Jimmy. Jimmy tried to wear the right suits. It didn't matter. Jimmy tried to actually play by the law, and they would find a technicality to just hold him back. And then it got to the point where they just started abusing the spirit of the law because they could. Jimmy McGill said enough's enough. Saul Goodman was born as a product of the marketplace. So that was where we get into. Now I'd like to tell you what I'd like the people to understand about Greta Thunberg and the Sierra Club. Humans have been, and this is what we write about in our column, humans have been decarbonizing as a species for over 150 years. If you look at the research from the Rockefeller Group, it clearly shows how societies have gone from wood and hay to whales to coal to crude oil to natural gas. That is an unbelievable history of decarbonization that was happening long before Greta Thunberg or the Sierra Club came along. Now, fast forward a little bit in my column, and I ask, okay, it's time for the American oil and gas industry to have a serious look in the mirror, because many of the same appointed leaders are still in power. It's time for the American gas industry to ask those appointed leaders and those Madison Avenue marketing executives how they got their butt kicked by a 16-year-old girl from Europe. What happened to home turf? I now give you that loaded hand grenade, sir.
No, you're absolutely right. And she's the perfect poster child for this movement, because she is young. She is a female, so she's unattackable, right? I mean, I would talk to a number of editors. I write regularly as part of my job, and people would say, look, we're not taking pieces about attacking a 16-year-old girl. And I thought, boy, I wish Power of the Future could find a 16-year-old, you know, to be our spokesperson, because then we could talk about the importance of the fossil fuel industry and not be under attack. So she's a perfect foil for anyone who disagrees with her message. You know, I look at the year 2019 when COVID was not yet a thing and the world did not turn upside down. I look at it from the perspective of this industry. We produced more oil and gas than we had done in decades, and we were actually exporting for the first time. We brought in record oil and gas revenue to the federal treasury. Unfortunately, we've got a government that spent it faster than they could come in, but regardless of that economic point, we brought in more oil and gas revenue than we had before. We were employing a fairly high number of oil and gas workers at some of the highest salaries they had ever seen. And we had the oil and gas prices at an average low that were pretty good. It wasn't the lowest in history, but their price points were historically very, very average. And we lowered emissions more than any other country that was part of the Paris Climate Accord. I look at those five, is that a quinfecta, can you call it, the hat trick times two? I've looked at those five or six criteria together in 2019 and said, this is everything the environmental left told us should not be able to happen. We should not produce more for less, for a greater number of people, and lower emissions. And the reason why we did that is we did not discover a new oil patch. Donald Trump did not approve a new technology that was allowed to go on the market. What happened, and I don't mean all he did, because it's huge what the administration did, but all he did was he allowed the free market to do what it does best. And when you give people freedom, they will produce more for less for the greatest number of people in the most efficient way possible. It's the course of mankind in a free market. And by allowing the free market in the energy space to do this, and then look at the trickle down from everything else, the businesses that were started, the people who expanded, homes were expanding because things were cheap. Goods were relatively cheap. Unemployment was historic lows. Minority unemployment was at historic lows because energy was cheap. And energy was cheap because of freedom. Biden does not ultimately believe in free people. He's a statist. He thinks he, as the collective head, knows what the collective needs. And he, as a true statist, decides, I know what will help this country run. I know what the energy needs of this country are. I have thus decreed that we need to buy wind and solar from Chinese Uyghur slaves and give them the jobs and give them the money, et cetera. And because of that huge philosophical difference, we're headed towards a very bad place in our country. It's the disconnect I talked about earlier on, but it is an enormous philosophical difference. The statist, the collectivist versus the person who believes in freedom. And I don't know, quite frankly, I don't know how we reconcile those two visions. I don't.
Well, it's tough. I mean, judgment is the gateway to fear and anger. And when people are afraid and anger, they're easily controlled because they just react. They just react. And honestly, that's been my number one complaint about the oil and gas industry, is that they went from telling their story and having the narrative from the old wildcatter days to I don't know what the heck happened with Dallas and J.R. Ewing, but apparently the greed took over, and then all of a sudden now they're the dirtiest people on the planet. So something happened to where this narrative went from rags to riches, the oil industry does great things for us, you know, to now where we're at today. And it's not lost on me at all. You know, this is, I think people need to realize this is happening and it is here. It is real. And a big part of it has to do with your leadership and who you're putting in there, because they're either enabling it or they're fighting for you. And we're about ready to go from being American. And by the way, we only got a few minutes left here because we told Rachel 20 minutes and we're getting close to 60 now. And we should
The conversation's been incredible, though.
And we could go for another 4 hours and we'll have to have you back. But I did want to talk about Nord 2 and Russia and the Ukraine because we do news programs and I want to make sure we get some news out of this and we create it. But this is really where we're leading to. And so the last 45 minutes, folks, has been context for where we're at now, which is we are faced in a world right now where it's very difficult to have a scientific conversation because so much emotion has been placed into the world of science. And when you have emotion placed into the world of science, you can get fear and judgment and all these different things. The word frack is actually a great scientific word, but it was developed when that word was okay. Well, now they're actually kind of using it against them in the same way the word gay and the word retarded had to be changed. Those, when I grew up, those were actually the actual preferred government chosen school taught you words. Now you get expelled. You know, by the same institution that taught me, that same building with new people are now expelling kids that say these things. So I get that. Now, all right, where we're at today, we actually truly do have an administration, a leader who figured out a way to make it better for America to mine coal. And then all of a sudden the 70s and 80s went away. And in the 90s, he went away. And then in the 2000s, he figured out a way to end coal. That guy's been there the whole time, and he's in office. He's the president. So he's not alone. They change their tune. They change their colors. And that's where we're at. We are about ready to now become reliant on Russia for energy. Explain to me how you got there, because I got there too. How did you come to that conclusion?
Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable. I mean, we oil is a global commodity. I get it. People will always, you know, yell at me on Twitter. The president doesn't set the price of oil. I'm not saying he does, but the president does have the ability to impact supply, and supply, just by the laws of economics, will impact the price. There's a reason why for the last couple of years Vladimir Putin was quiet. One, he probably saw in President Trump a very unpredictable and also a strong leader, but a guy like, I don't know what the heck this guy's going to do. Well, next thing you know, he's walking into North Korea and shaking his hand, and then he's telling Angela Merkel off. And so, you know, he saw that. But on the other hand, he also did nothing, Vladimir Putin, for a couple of years because he didn't have the cash. Right? I mean, 40% of the Russian economy is oil and gas, is fossil fuel sales. And he didn't have the money that he currently has now. I wish the Lord Almighty had distributed fossil fuel reserves differently, right? I wish we found oil and gas in different parts of the world. But for America and Canada and maybe Scandinavia, most of the oil and gas is found under the feet of some pretty bad actors. And Russia is a prime example of that. We've made the price point so high that we've made him very rich. We've made the Ayatollah a lot more rich and powerful. There have been lots of little skirmishes that barely make the news, but lots of little skirmishes in the past month where Iran-backed militants have launched attacks in the UAE, for example. But we've also hurt our supply so much in America that we need to make up for it. And if we don't get it from Canada, we import an awful lot for refining purposes. People will, if you don't know the industry, you say, America still imports oil even when Trump was president. Yeah, we do, because we refine a lot of it, and our import-export numbers are always a little skewed because of what we import to refine and what we export to refine. We refine all of Venezuela's oil. I'm sure you know that, or your audience knows that. But I tell your average American, Venezuela has very little, if no, refining capability. And the Gulf of Mexico, the Mississippi Delta, is where he sends his oil to refine. So, yes, we still import oil from bad actors. That's just sadly how this industry works. It's very complex. But we need to make up for our oil and gas supply. And if we don't get it domestically, we have to get it elsewhere. Or there's a trade-off. The trade-off is prices continue to surge through the roof, or we cut off parts of the economy. And there's a reason why people want to manufacture in China. There's no human rights or employee rights. There's no OSHA. There's also no environmental regulation, and it's cheap. So you can manufacture your goods with their coal-fired plants and not have to pay the price for electricity that you have to pay for a plant in America. So that's where we're headed. Right now, there are tankers of Russian natural gas in Boston Harbor. There are also tankers from Trinidad and Tobago because they have huge natural gas exports. Why do we have Russian and Trinidadian natural gas in Boston Harbor for New England? Because New England refuses to build a pipeline to the Marcellus Shale region. The Massachusetts Attorney General, Maura Healey, is on the record saying she would rather buy natural gas from Russia than build a pipeline to Pennsylvania. As far as I'm concerned, that's sedition, you know, and she should be not just kicked out of office, she should be brought up on trial. We're paying money to have, and also if you care about the environment, what's the footprint? What's the carbon footprint, that magic word, of a tanker crossing the Atlantic Ocean full of Russian natural gas as opposed to a pipeline from Marcellus Shale? So Putin gets the revenue, he gets the jobs, and Massachusetts buys his product now at a premium because they're paying the transportation costs, right? They're paying the import costs. And this is where we're headed. So we've made Russia rich. The last year has made Vladimir Putin rich. He also recognizes Biden's incredible weakness and, very tragically, his senility. He realizes he's a weak leader, but he also is flush with cash. And our decisions have made him flush. Joe Biden, if he wants to really end this skirmish, the easiest way to do it is what Reagan taught us in the 80s, bankrupt them. Take away their economy, and he can't afford his army. And the best way to bankrupt him is to produce so much damn oil and gas domestically that we flood the market. Prices will drop tremendously, and no one will buy his expensive product. But the only way to flood the market with supply domestically is to have people like Deb Haaland, the Secretary of the Interior, who just yesterday stopped more oil and gas leases. People like her have to be removed. Absolutely, the EPA has to be removed. All of these people who are punishing this industry, making it impossible to do their job, they are all, as far as I'm concerned, guilty of sedition. They are hurting. I mean, you know what? It could almost be treason because they are empowering a foreign government. Their direct action is causing Vladimir Putin to be richer and more powerful. And then simultaneously, and this is going to maybe even get me in trouble, so I apologize. And then simultaneously, they will have no problem sending some 18-year-old farm boy from Iowa to go die on a Ukrainian battlefield. Right. So we are making our enemy rich. And then we're saying, well, you know, here's the price of freedom, Joe Biden said yesterday. We all have to pay the price of freedom. What a load of crap. You know, we've never before made our enemies rich by our own stupidity, and yet we've been doing it now. Well, we've been doing it for China for 40 years, but now we're doing it with Russia.
If people can support you and give you a little bit of help, first of all, yeah, I mean, I should ask, you know, how do you make money? How can people, you know, support your cause? I'm looking at the clock here, so I want to make sure that we give you a plug for your business.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. We are a 501c4, so a nonprofit organization, powerthefuture.com. People can email me, Daniel at powerthefuture.com. I love talking to folks. I have to do all of our fundraising, so we talk to a lot of individuals who believe in our cause. We do a lot of direct mail. We do online and digital fundraising. We're not a huge operator. I don't have a Bloomberg yet to write me a $500 million check. I'm looking for him, but he's I haven't found him yet. But thank you. Thanks for letting me make a plug, because we do need people's support in this, on this ongoing effort. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. And God, I hope we can come back, because we haven't even talked about green energy.